Hello, I'm Cyan, if I haven't met you yet. And I'm going to take a pause while I grab this stool, actually. I am so appreciative that we're singing this song. I feel like the point of most of our messages is to just do that, you know? Is to look upon Jesus. And that's one of the reasons I love Door of Hope, is that pillar of the cross. Like, if we can just look at him, then the things that we're worried about, the things that bog us down, will grow strangely dim. They become things that we're not overly concerned about. If you guys want to open your Bibles to John chapter 8, we're picking up where you guys left off last week. But before that, C.S. Lewis, we're going to be talking about the devil a lot today, so don't get too scared. It's kind of hard to ever have a message about the devil without quoting C.S. Lewis's Screwtape Letters. If you haven't read it, super good. It's essentially C.S. Lewis writes as like an kind of takes the place of an older demon talking to a younger demon. It's really interesting. Anyways, but he opens it up in his preface and he says, "There are two equal and opposite errors into which our race can fall about the devils. The one is to disbelieve in their existence, and the other is to feel an excessive and unhealthy interest in them. They themselves are equally pleased with both errors and hail the materialist and the magician with the same delight." And so my prayer tonight in us talking about the devil is just that we can know his tactics or his tactic. And when he sticks his nose in our business, we can nip it in the bud and be like, "Get out of here, toy with you, Satan," essentially. That's essentially what we're going to be talking about tonight. So I'm going to back it up. So last week, Jesus said these intense words to the Pharisees. He says, "You will know the truth, and the truth will set you free." And he's talking to the Jews, and they answered him, "We are offspring of Abraham, and I've never been a slave to anyone. What do you mean we will become free?" And that's where we should laugh, because they haven't been free for a long time. So H.A. Ironside said this: "It is a striking instance of how men will bolster themselves up, even though their entire history proves far different conclusion. Imagine these men, these Jewish men, saying, 'We were never in bondage to any man.' Even as they spoke, the Romans had them in subjugation, and ever since the captivity of Babylon, they have been in bondage to one power after another." So Jesus says, I get to recap, he says, "You will know the truth and the truth will set you free." And they're like, "Well, we've never been enslaved." And that's like, we should laugh there. And then he kind of like twists it. He says, "Everyone who sins is a slave to sin. So if the Son sets you free, you will be free indeed." And then he says this: "I know that you are offspring of Abraham, yet you seek to kill me because my words find no place in you." We're going to return to that later, because I think that is one of the keys of the next few passages, is, "Yet you seek to kill me because of my words, because my words find no place in you. I speak of what I've seen with my Father, and you do what you have heard from your Father." And so now we're kind of caught up to speed. We're going to jump in. And so this is So the Jewish men reply with, they answered him, "Abraham is our father." And Jesus said to them, "If you were Abraham's children, you would be doing the works Abraham did. But now you seek to kill me, a man who has told you the truth that I heard from God. This is not what Abraham did. You are doing the works of your father." They said to him, We were not born of sexual immorality. We have one father, even God." And so Jesus' response is, You are not doing what Abraham did. What did Abraham do? He lived by faith. God showed up to him in word, and then he picked up his life, and he stepped out into risk. He stepped out into hardship. And then he's saying, you're calling yourself sons of Abraham, yet you resemble him very little. And then after that, he says, we were not born of sexual immorality. We have one father, even God. And so they kind of hear of the virgin birth and they kind of throw it back in his face. And they're saying, well, at least we have a dad, essentially, is their point. And so it just goes again back to like what Ian has been saying for months and what John says over and over again, is that Israel has once again forgotten their father. Israel continually forgets and forgets and forgets the father. If you doubt me, read Judges, where they just constantly forget that they have a father and a king that loves them. And yet they say, no, we want a king, we want a king, we want to govern ourselves, is what he says. Again, verse 37, you seek to kill me because my words find no place in you. Ironside said this again, the ritualists and the self-righteous never understand this, but are always looking within for deliverance, but deliverance comes from the outside. A lot of us have these pains and aches, and we think that if we could just control our own life, we could fix it. And so we try to muster up inside of us this deliverance from within, and it just doesn't happen. You don't save yourself from drowning. You have to be saved. So deliverance has to come from the outside. So verse 42, Jesus said to them, if God were your father, you would love me, for I came from God and I am here. I came not of my own accord, but he sent me. Why do you not understand what I say? It is because you cannot bear to hear my word. Again, his word cannot find a place in them. Once again, the story, they fail to recognize their own father. And I can't help it. There are two lyrics that came to mind when I was preparing this. One is Christian Zema, a great songwriter. He said, we've grown older than our God. And it's the idea of we've forgotten him. We've grown too old to come under God. And then God is young, and maybe we're the ones that grow old. We're the ones that grow too old for them. They're talking about childlike faith. We need to remain under God. And the people have... We are people that want no king. We want no governance. We don't want someone to put things on us. And that is what these Jewish men, these Pharisees, are scared of. They don't want Jesus to be king. They don't want there to be something that they don't like. They're expecting something that they have control over. They're expecting something that'll bolster their own desires. And here's the kicker that we're going to talk about the most tonight. You are of your father, the devil, and your will is to do your father's desires. He was a murderer from the beginning and does not stand in the truth because there is no truth in him. When he lies, he speaks out of his own character, for he is a liar and the father of lies. So there's two aspects of these passages that I'm going to focus on tonight. I'm sure there's more. But one is, I think this comparison of calling these Jewish men the devil gives us a keen insight to how we can and do get in the way of the now and the not yet of the kingdom of God. I think this there's a fundamental in comparing human people and how they've fallen to devilish workings. I think there's something for us to learn into how do we find ourselves as a stumbling block to God's kingdom and how it's coming. And then it also gives us a large framework for how Jesus saw the devil, one of the three enemies of the soul. The three enemies of the soul are the world, the flesh, and the devil. We're going to talk about how Jesus saw the devil for a little bit, and then we'll tackle the how do we get in the way. Now, if you're picturing Daffy Duck in red spandex with a red tail and horns and a pitchfork, perfect, because that's exactly what the devil looks like, at least in my mind. And one of the reasons, I every time I hear a talk on the devil, I feel like there's always this long explanation of what they think the devil like, or what do you think his personality is like, or whatever. And I find that really interesting, because the Bible has oddly very little to say of what he looks like, very little to say of his... personality, or they pretty much only has to say of what he wants and what he does. And I think this is important because I believe the Bible focuses very little on the devil's appearance, because in the grand scheme of eternity, he will be a moot point. Like right now we're plagued by what the devil does, but in the grand scheme of eternity, he will be a moot point, a failure not worth reading about. And so, the devil. The devil just means the slanderer. And then another name is Satan. It just means the accuser, which I think is really appropriate because that's what he does. And so I just want to talk about what the devil wants. And ultimately, what the devil wants is to separate. He just wants to do anything to hurt God. And it's kind of hard to define what the devil wants without defining what God is, because God is the creator, and the only thing the devil can do is distort. The only thing he can do is play a dissonant note. And so God's vision is that he wants to partner with his humanity in taking this world somewhere. He wants to partner in love with us. That's what the garden is. And I think this is really obvious when someone comes up to Jesus and says, what are the two greatest commandments? And he says, well, love God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. And then he says, love your neighbor as yourself. He says, be with me and be good children, and then also love one another. And so we have to assume that the devil's goal is to separate you and God and to separate you and people. So Satan, and the way he does that is through lies. I think that's one of the key parts of this verse, is that he does not stand in truth. There is no truth in him. When he lies, he speaks his native tongue. And so the question is what does he want us to do? And so I would propose, one, he wants us to dethrone God in our minds, and he wants us to dehumanize people. And so what I mean by that is what the devil lies about is he wants you to set God aside in your mind and think about anything else, and he'll use anything. And then he wants you to see other people and then see them either as less than yourself, or if he can get you to raise someone else into the God's level, he will. And so it's that idea of taking someone that's made in the image of God and then turning them into anything else. It's that idea of tearing someone down in your mind, or of building them up to this point of Godhood in your head. And so Satan tells lies about God, lies about people's worth, lies about the love of God, lies about how you are seen in God's eyes, lies about how others are seen in God's eyes. And you see this very evident in the garden whenever he goes up to Eve and he says, did God really say that? That's what the devil sounds like. He sounds like doubt. He sounds like hate and unforgiveness. John Mark Comer just released a book around these passages. It's really good, and I wanted to share this one section of it. And he's talking about the three enemies of the soul. As followers of Jesus, we are at war with the world, the flesh, and the devil. The three enemies' stratagems is as follows. Deceptive ideas, the devil, that play to disordered desires, the flesh, that are normalized in a sinful society, the world. And so what all that means is that the devil wants you to see people and then dehumanize them. And that's how we create discord in our world. That's how evil remains. And again, think of Eve in the garden. And think of Israel wanting a king outside of what God designed for them. Think about how you call shots on your life without God. Think about how many decisions you make without him or against him. And look at the world filled with people saying, live your truth and you do you. It's the idea of we're going to be our own God. And it's spurred on by the devil's thoughts. It's spurred on by him accusing you and slandering you. So the words that come to mind is he is the tempter and the accuser. He's the one that says, did God really say that? He's the one that says, is that person really worth all that trouble? Do they actually deserve my forgiveness? Does God really have my best interest in heart? And then as soon as you act on any of those doubts, he's the accuser that throws it back in your face. You know what God said. Of course they're worth it. And I can't help but think of Judas. Satan is the voice in Judas's head that pushes him to sell out Jesus. He's also the voice in Judas's head to throw the money at the Pharisees' feet and go hang himself. He's both. He does both of those things. And just for a moment, I want to kind of go back in John into the beginning of 8, and the woman caught in adultery. This woman, Jesus is teaching in the temple and is interrupted by the Pharisees dragging this naked and abandoned woman in front of him to be used merely as a prop to explain their point. Is drug out naked and seemingly abandoned by her lover in the streets in front of a controversial figure as nothing more than a prop to prove a point, and is apparently instigated by the sons of Satan. It's this idea that this woman has These men have dehumanized her down to a prop, to play nothing, to prove nothing more than a point, and this woman has forgotten the love and care of a father. How does this happen? How does the devil sow these seeds of deception in our heart? John 8:45. But because I tell you the truth, you do not believe me. Which one of you convicts me of sin? If I tell you the truth, why do you not believe me? Whoever is of God hears the words of God. The reason why you do not hear them is that you are not of God. It's the idea that we forget God's voice. And so any voice that pops in our head, we're like, yeah, that seems right. That seems like what we're going for. Another way you could say that is that the reason for their devilry is that they have not submitted God's ownership of their lives. They do not belong to God. So the great question for us tonight is, do we belong to God? Back to that verse 37 is, you seek to kill me, but because my words find no place in your heart. And we have to ask, does his words find places in our heart? And it's back to, I think this is just such a beautiful picture because it's this woman that has been drug out by this outside force, and she's stuck and she feels shame and abandonment. And then in this is Jesus' reaction. And as they continued to ask him, he stood up and said to them, "Let him who is without sin among you be the first to throw a stone at her." And once more he bent down and wrote on the ground. When they heard it, they went away one by one, beginning with the older ones, and Jesus was left alone with the woman standing before him. Jesus stood up and said to her, "Woman, where are they? Has no one condemned you?" She said, "No one, Lord." And Jesus said, "Neither do I condemn you. Go, and from now on, sin no more." And it's an intense story, but it's this idea of you're stuck. You have these people pointing at you, pointing out what you've done wrong, and they're right. And they're right. Like, the Pharisees are right. And that's where we find ourselves when outside voices, whenever he says, you've become the sons of Satan, you've become the sons of the devil, it's that idea, because that's what Satan does. He goes and he finds out he's a lion prowling around for who he may devour. He's looking for you and your shame to point out and saying, no, God is not okay with this, and he's not going to forgive you, and you just might as well forget it and move on. That's the idea, but that is not how Jesus reacts. And it reminds me, this is a really funny story, but I think it illustrates it really well. In middle school, my entire school career, I was a terrible, terrible student. And it's kind of hard to judge because I was homeschooled and I was in a really intense school program. And so it's like, I can't tell if I was just like really dumb for a smart kid or really smart for a dumb kid. It was kind of like one of those things. And so we started my eighth grade year, we had a mock trial. I don't know, has anyone been in a mock trial? Yeah, 1, 2, 3. Sweet. So in a mock trial, you're given the trial, and you have like months to like kind of plan how you're going to defend yourself or whatever. And anyways, no one trusted me to do any of the actual work. And we didn't have like actors, so they were like, you can just act like the defendant and just don't answer questions directly. That's the only thing they trusted me with. Anyways, I had to play this German guy, and so I went all out. I learned a German accent. It was awesome. I forgot it. I'm not going to demonstrate it here. And so, anyways, the time comes, and I feel incredibly unprepared, even though all I had to do was say no when I'm on the defense. Anyway, so I get up there, and this is in North Carolina, and we have like we were all excited because we hired like an actual judge to like represent us, and he had like the thickest Southern accent of all time. And so I got up there, and I gave my probably a terrible German accent, like atrocious. And I remember like afterwards, I was like going to the bathroom, and he was like walking in. He's like, "Are you a foreign exchange student?" And I was like, "No, no, North Carolina man." It was so funny. Anyways, that's not the point of the story. That is totally off track. The point of the story is I find myself in being yelled at by this cross-examiner, and he's asking this question. And here's the problem, is if you ask a question outside the scope of the trial, it doesn't count. So he asked me a question that had nothing to do with the script. And so I can't answer that because it would be breaking the rules of the mock trial. It just doesn't work. And so at that point, your defendants have to object. The problem is that my defendants were sixth grade girls, and they were really shy about this guy that was like probably 13, but he hit a growth spurt early. And he was like yelling at me this question that was outside of the scope of the trial, but the judge didn't know what was outside of the scope of the trial because he didn't read the script. So I'm just standing there and I'm like trying to give an answer that doesn't get us in trouble and help us lose the mock trial. And eventually he was asking if a certain word was in German. And eventually eventually I just like yelled out, I was like, does that sound like German to you? In the best German accent I could. And the entire courtroom just died laughing because it was getting heated. Like it was about to go fisticuffs. And essentially, even the judge dies laughing, and we lost the mock trial because I made a joke. And I was like, are you serious? Anyways, I'm just laughing at this funny example. But that's kind of like where we end up. We get put on trial for something, and we feel like we don't have a good defense, and then we just start making stuff up, and you're like, I don't know how to fight my own battles, and you're trying to save yourself. You're trying to deliver yourself from within, but deliverance comes from without, and it's because Christ is a good advocate. Christ shows up in those moments to defend you. He says, this is outside the scope of the trial because my blood has covered his guilt. And so when Satan comes at you with shame and pointing a finger, that's what you have to realize, is that Jesus has paid for this, and I can't carry this anymore. And I have to look at the cross, and I have to ignore this guy that's yelling in front of me and look to the person that's paid my debt. I promise it had a point. I like really, this is a stretch, but you know it's there. And so 1 John 2:1-2, it says, my little children, I'm writing these things to you so that you may not sin. But if anyone does sin, we have an advocate with the Father, Jesus Christ, the righteous. He is the propitiation of our sins, and not for ours only, but also the sins of the world. Deliverance comes from the outside. And so that was one side of how the devil works. He just lies. And he lies to get you to doubt God, and he lies to get you to believe that God doesn't love you anymore, that God doesn't want you anymore. And you have to, that's why I love the song earlier, is we have to keep our eyes fixed on Jesus. And it's really subtle. Like I remember for the longest time, I operated, my baseline motive for life is I wanted to be enough. And I didn't know what that meant. And I just remember when I was a little kid, it's a long story, but I was trying to help my dad had this ministry, and I was like 12 years old trying to like work like heavy machinery because that was a good idea. And I was trying my hardest. And then eventually this like teenage girl yelled at me, and she was like, get out of the way. You're like getting in, whatever, freaked out on me. And ever since that moment, it hit me. I was like, maybe I'm not enough to do what someone wants me to. And from that point in my life, the rest of my life, until a couple years ago, I just believed, like, maybe I'm not enough. Maybe I'm not enough for God to love me. Maybe I'm not enough for God to make a difference in my life. And that was a demonic thought. That was from the devil. That's what he does. He plants seeds of you're not enough. You're not what God wants. That's not true, because he has paid for you. I remember when I experienced breakthrough for this, I was worshiping, and it's the closest thing to a vision I've ever had. It was so cool. I was praying, and I saw myself in the streets of Jerusalem, and I saw a bloody man carrying a cross down to me, and it was cheesy, but he looked up at me, and he fell down, and I tried to pick him back up, and he says, no, you can't help me. It's like, I have to do this for you, because you're enough. And it hit home in a way that it never has. And that is what you have to keep your eyes on. You keep your eyes focused on the cross and what he's done for you. And then after that, after you understand that about the devil, it really gets to the heart of what this chapter is about in the context of the verse, is that, and if we have been forgiven, we cannot operate with stones in our hands. What I love about this verse of the woman caught in adultery is that Jesus represents what we are supposed to do in that instance. I've always been weirded out by he was like drawing with his finger in the dirt. And I was just kind of like meditating and thinking about that all week. And I don't know if this is the right answer. I did not read this in a commentary. This is just something that I thought of. But if this naked woman has been drawn out and humiliated, to be drawn out in front of the Creator would be humiliating, especially when she's guilty. And so the idea of Jesus not looking at her really struck me, looking at her and her guilt. And so his eyes fixed on the ground is how he defends her, which is so beautiful. His eyes fixed on the dirt, that I have to assume that he's praying in that moment, Lord, how do I respond to this? How do I get out of this? And also remembering dirt that Adam was made out of. Remembering that God at one time looked down at dirt and thought, I'm going to make a creation out of that, and it's going to be the love that I chase after. And so as he's looking at this dirt drawing in the fingers, he says, you who is without sin, cast the first stone. He defends her. And then after she's been defended, he says, has anyone condemned you? Nor do I condemn you. Go and sin no more. And that's what I believe we are to do, rather than be the sons of Satan that drag her out. And so the idea that I just want to talk about for just a short second, and then I'll wrap it up, is John Mark Comer asks this cool question in the book, is how do we become more like Jesus and not like the devil? George MacDonald said this, a man may sink by such a slow degrees... I wrote that down wrong, I'm sorry. My English is not the greatest. Slow degrees that long after he is a devil, he may go on being a good churchman or a good dissenter and thinking himself a good Christian. There's something that I was kind of scared about being in a Portland setting, sharing this message, because the main point of this message is really against kind of self-righteousness. And for a long time, I was like, self-righteousness is really just for people that are like old people that are in the church and they're all pious and stuff. And that only happens in the South, as if that were true. And I was really convicted about it. And I was kind of like, how am I, like people that come to church here really mean it. Like they really find God because they have to. And then I was kind of convicted because me and Kristen were driving down the car, or driving down the car. We were driving down the road in a car. And Kristen looks at me and she's like, what are you doing? And we passed something, and I don't know if you ever do this, but you find yourself in this imaginary argument with someone that doesn't even exist. Does that make sense? We passed this school, and I, for some reason, had this encounter in my mind. I was like, man, what if they said this about my kid that I don't have, and the teacher that I don't know if they exist. And I came up in this like full-on argument with this defending my child that doesn't exist. And I was like literally like moving my mouth, and Kristen's like, what are you doing? And I'm like, I don't know. I'm just arguing. And I thought about how funny that is and how self-righteous we can be. And this is an odd equation. But we find ourselves, and we find ourselves on the right side of what we believe, and then we imaginate like adversaries, and it's literally like training to not love people. That's essentially what it is. It's like, I know exactly when I'm going to tell this person that doesn't exist when they say this thing that's probably not going to happen, and that'll show them. And it's this idea of that, like, we literally, there's something in us that plans for this. There's something in us that plans to not love people. And it's this self-righteousness. It is devilish. It's this thing that seeks out the harm of another person. And yeah. Sorry, I skipped my notes, and I forgot that I wrote in my notes to tell that story. And what I wrote it down was, is imaginary argument, shower thoughts. That's funny to me. It doesn't have to be funny to you. It's okay. 1 Peter says, first, be sober-minded, be watchful. Your adversary, the devil, prowls around like a roaring lion, seeking seeking someone to devour. Now, the point of this verse is to be alert of the devil, but also, apparently, we can be devilish characters. And we can be the type of people that are looking for an argument. We can be the type of people that are looking for someone to disagree. Someone that we can devour. Someone that we can beat in some way or another. Matthew 23:13-5, he's talking to the Pharisees. He says, "Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you shut the kingdom of heaven in people's faces, for you neither enter yourselves nor allow those who would enter to go in. Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you travel across the sea and land and make a single proselyte. And when he becomes a proselyte, you make him twice as much a child of hell as yourselves." This idea of chasing down a problem, it sounds more extreme, but so many of us have someone on the other side of the aisle, the other side of our opinion, and they are diminished and dehumanized to a point that is grotesque for a Christian to think about. And it's this idea that we do not love like 1 Corinthians 13. We do the opposite of this. It says, it does not rejoice at wrongdoing, but rejoices with the truth. Love bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. My love doesn't do that. It's a lot more like a lion seeking for whom it might devour. I love the people that agree with me. I love the people that have the same thoughts as me. But then as soon as someone else doesn't, then I'm like, all right, you're out. And it's this idea of the wheat and the weeds. This is kind of what I'm going to end on, is give or take end on. Is Jesus says this parable. He says some tenants are essentially these farm workers come, and he says, they're like, "Oh no, someone planted the weeds in with the wheat. What are we going to do?" He says, should we just tear up the weeds so that the wheat can thrive? And he says, no, let the weeds and the wheat grow together. And so these passages, the convicting part of what does it mean for us to look more like the devil and Jesus, is really hard when there's weeds amongst us. And most of the time, a lot of the wheat that we see, we mislabel as weeds. And Jesus knows that. Jesus knows that we're bad judges on whose wheat. We're bad judges on whose weeds. And so he says, just live in love with these people. I'm really convicted by this. Love believes all things. Love hopes all things, endures all things. Do we hope all things for people? Do we do that? George MacDonald said this: love makes everything lovely. Hate concentrates itself on the one thing hated. And this is what the devil wants. I mean, ultimately, we find ourselves as the men who drug the woman out and the woman. That's the problem, is we find ourselves as victims that the devil has preyed on, and we find ourselves hurting and broken, and we need to look at the Father that's defending us. But we also drag people out, and we say, God, look at them. Like deal with them, because I don't want to love them, essentially. It's like, I don't want to go that far. I don't want to do that. And I think that if we're going to be people that persist in doing that, he has a very similar message to us. He has a very similar message to us. You're looking more like the devil than me. And so that's pretty dark thought. But I wanted to end, because someday Jesus is going to come back and the devil's going to be no more. Isaiah 11 says, "The wolf shall dwell with the lamb, the leopard shall lie down with the young goat, and the calf and the lion will, and the calf and the lion and the fattened calf together, and the little child shall lead them. The cow and the bear shall graze together, and the young shall lie down together, and the lion shall eat straw like an ox, the nursing child shall play over the hole of a cobra, and the weaned child shall put its hand on the adder's den." I love this verse, mainly because I've heard like the wolf will lay down the lamb and the leopard and all that stuff before, but I never thought of a baby hanging out with a snake And I thought, at first it made me laugh, and then I was like, it's very obvious I don't have kids, because that made me laugh. But it's this idea of the thing that God, or the thing that the devil meant for evil, a snake. He uses this snake to tempt Eve in the garden as the very thing we'll be comfortable leaving our kids around when Jesus comes back. And obviously this is poetic and whatnot, but there's something profound about it, that something unfathomable is going to happen, and we'll be able to leave our kids with something that was meant for tremendous harm. Because one day, Satan will find himself without a tongue. And the lies will stop, and the self-doubting will stop, and the self-hating will stop. And we'll see Jesus face to face. That's the hope. So, that's all I got. I'm going to pray real quick, and then we have communion up here, and so we get to share in that one day Jesus is going to come back bodily. He's going to come, and he's going to make all things new. The Satan will find himself without a tongue. It's not going to be around much longer. And so with that, and back to the ideas, as I want my prayer, I'll just pray. You know, I was going to say my prayer even though I'm about to pray. That's ridiculous, so I'll pray. God, my prayer is that we become more acquainted with you. God, I pray that truth would be on our minds, and that truth would pervade and pursue us, that light would shine in our lives, that we know the enemy's voice compared to yours. We know the voice to ignore, and we know the voice to look upon. God, that we know that the cross is our main focus, that your blood paid a price that no other person has ever paid, that you bankrupt heaven that you can love us. God, we are elated to worship you. God, we love you. And God, let us see our brothers and sisters as children of God, as images of you that we can love. God, teach us to teach our love to believe all things, hope all things, and endure all things. Make us more like you and less like the enemy. In Jesus' name, amen.